Go for it, Scott.
I'll send you a link to that film as well if anybody wants it. Okay, let's review our syllogism. Premise one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Conclusion, therefore, abortion is wrong. You are all philosophers. I am impressed. Good work. Science has shown us that the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. But science cannot tell us how to value human beings, regardless of their age, whether in utero or 98 years old. Science tells us what the unborn is. We have to do a little philosophy to know how to value them. What I'd like you to do right now is stare around the room. Just go ahead, stare at some people. Just turn and give them. Guys, if there's any cute girls here and you're young and unmarried, now is your God-ordained, sanctified moment to look. Don't laugh, I met my wife that way. Look around the room. All right? Well, where do you want me to meet her? In a bar? I met her in church when the pastor said the same thing I just said to you. Now, what makes us equal? You are staring around the room. We all believe in equality, correct? Why are we equal? Do we all have equal athletic ability? I am 55. I now qualify for the Taco Bell discount, which I refuse to participate in. I can still shoot three-pointers on the basketball court. I could beat any of you in horse. Here's my problem. When I actually play in a pickup game now, I never get open to take the three-point shot because I'm too slow. I don't have the athletic ability I once did. So if equality is based on athletic ability, we're toast, right? Is it based on intellectual ability? Are we all equally self-aware in this room right now? Some of you are going, man, I had a shot of caffeine in my coffee at 8 o'clock this morning, and I'm on the backside of that. I'm almost comatose. Others of you, you're flying. If our value is based on intellectual ability, we don't have equality, do we? Do we all equally have a desire to live? Some of you have had great years. It's been phenomenal for you. And some of you this last year, you don't know how you crawled in here tonight. The stuff you've had to face, the hurdles you've had to face, grief, rejection, hurt. You're not suicidal, but honestly, you're not all that excited about what the future holds for you. If desire is what grounds a right to life, those with more desire have a greater right to life than those with less, right? There's only one thing we all share equally in this room, men and women. We all have the same human nature. We're all equally human. When did you get your human nature? The moment you began to exist. When did you begin to exist? Fertilization. Human parents produce human offspring. And if anybody doubts that, ask him how it's possible for two human parents to create offspring that isn't human but later becomes so. I think, to quote Ricky Ricardo, they have some splaining to do. Right? That wasn't really good, but anyway. We're all equally human because we have the same human nature. Now, there's another way you can illustrate human equality to people. You can ask a very simple question. Tell me, what difference is there between the embryo you once were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you at that earlier stage? As Stephen Schwartz has pointed out, there's four differences between the embryo you were and the adults you are today, and not one of them is a good reason for saying you could be killed then but not now. Those four differences are size, level of development, environment, meaning where we're located, and degree of dependency. I want you to think of the acronym SLED as a reminder of these four differences. Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency. The question is, are any of those four differences relevant such that we can say you could be killed then but not now? And I'm about to show you why none of them are relevant. Size, were you smaller as an embryo than you are today? Since when does body size, though, determine value? Men are generally larger than women. Do men deserve more rights than women simply because we're larger on balance? Does Shaquille O'Neal, the 7'2" former basketball star who spent his career with the LA Lakers before he committed mortal sin and went to the Celtics, he's a foot taller than everybody in this room. Is he more human and valuable because of it? Body size doesn't give you value. What about your level of development? Were you less developed as an embryo, as a fetus, than you are today? My question is so. Let me just a little pause. We're going to deal with this tomorrow, but just a little preview. We've got to get past the point of letting people assert things without arguing for them. Since when does development determine value? They've got to argue for that. It's not enough to just assert it. 2-year-old girls are less developed than 21-year-old young women. 2-year-old girls do not have a developed reproductive system yet. Are they less human and valuable than the 21-year-old young woman who does? Students, those of you here today, you are less developed than your parents. You are less developed than your parents physically, and you are less developed than your parents intellectually, though that comes as a complete shock to you. The reality is, you're not going to reach your intellectual peak till your mid-40s. Does it follow your parents have a greater right to life than you simply because they're more developed? By the way, this was precisely the point Abraham Lincoln would make when he would debate slavery proponents. Guys like Douglas and others would say, the slave differs from us. His skin is a different color. And here was Lincoln's response. And I'm going to quote him word for word because it's so powerful. Lincoln said this to his critics. You say man A is white? Man B is dark? Oh, it is skin color then? The fair-skinned man has the right to enslave the dark-skinned man? Take care, by that rule, you're a slave to the first person you meet with skin fairer than your own. Oh, you say it's not skin color? It's a matter of intellect? The white man, you allege, has superior intellect to the dark man? Take care yet again. By that rule, you're a slave to the first person you meet with an intellect superior to yours. You say it's not skin color? It's not intellect, it's interest. The white man, you allege, has the interest of enslaving the dark man. Take care again. By that rule, you're a slave to the first person who can make it his interest to enslave you. Do you see what Lincoln just did there? Any argument used to disqualify that African man worked real well for whites. And at least a guy like Peter Singer, the guy who champions infanticide, at least he's consistent. Because Peter Singer says this, hey, Planned Parenthood, you can't have it both ways. The fetus isn't self-aware, you allege, neither is the newborn. You want to spare the newborn. That doesn't work. You can kill both. Now, that's an appalling conclusion, right? But do you see the consistency of what he's arguing? Size, level of development. What about environment, where you were located? You were in the womb, now you're out. But how does where you are change what you are? How many came from Bozeman? I want to see those hands again. That's 2.5 hours, right, at least? You changed location in coming here. You didn't stop being you. If that's true, how does a journey of 7 inches down the birth canal suddenly transform you from a non-human, non-valuable thing we can kill to a valuable human being that we can't? Answer, if you weren't already human and valuable, how do you get there just by changing your address? And finally, degree of dependency, size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency, think SLED. And yes, this will be in the notes. How does it follow that because you depend on another human being, you can be killed? This is risky, but I'm already out on a limb, so here goes. I live in Noonan, Georgia. You've never heard of Noonan, Georgia, but some of you have seen Noonan, Georgia, because Noonan, Georgia is where they filmed the television series The Walking Dead. Have any of you heard of this series? It's a zombie series. And yes, I'm a huge fan of it because the worldview themes in it are unbelievable. It's about a virus that breaks out and turns dead people into walkers who bite other people who then become walkers. It's pretty gross, so be aware. But here's the storyline. The hero of the show is Sheriff Rick Grimes. And what happens is, in episode one, season one, he and his buddy, he's a sheriff, they're out on a run, they encounter criminals, they get in a gunfight, he gets shot, he's in a coma, and while he's in a month-long coma in the hospital, the zombie apocalypse breaks out. He wakes up in the hospital all alone, and he has to go try to find his family and figure out what happened. That's season one. Let's change the story. Rick gets shot, goes to the hospital, the zombie apocalypse breaks out, and instead of being deserted, as actually happened, one doctor stays behind to care for Rick. Rick depends totally on him for survival. Would it be okay for that doctor to kill Sheriff Rick because Rick depends totally on him for survival? Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency. Think SLED. Those are the only four differences between that embryo you were and the adult you are today, and not one of those is a good reason for saying you could be killed then but not now. Now, we're going to do something fun now. Everybody get ready for next Thanksgiving. You're at the Thanksgiving table. Aunt Betty, who is not a thinker of the same persuasion as you, has come from out of town, and you dread Aunt Betty coming every year because she stirs up quite a bit of dissension, given you don't hold her view, and she certainly doesn't hold yours. And in between bites of stuffing, she turns to you and says, "So, why aren't you pro-choice? Why are you, whatever you call yourself, pro-life?" Everybody get ready. Here's your 60-second answer. Ready? And somebody's going to time me when I tell you. Or you're in front of the press, and the reporter puts that microphone in front of you and says, "Why are you pro-life?" Here's your answer. Ready? Who's got the watch? All right? When I say go, go. Go. "Aunt Betty, I'm pro-life because the science of embryology tells us that from the earliest stages of development, you were a distinct, living, and whole human being. You weren't part of another human being like these skin cells on the back of my hand. You were yourself a distinct, whole living member of the human family. And you know what else, Aunt Betty? There's no essential difference between that embryo you were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you back then. Differences of size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then but not now." Did I get it done in a minute? Did I just make an argument? Did I give reasons for my view? How many Bible verses? That's right. Now Aunt Betty has to answer my argument. And by the way, that 1 minute soundbite will be in your notes. In fact, I'm going to post it on your Facebook page for the group tonight. If I can get, I can't get internet connection yet here. They're working on it. But assuming it's not viable. Anyway. Is it still a hotel, though? No, anyway. I'm ready to lodge a complaint. Anyway, no. All right. Now let's look at some ways people are going to respond to this pro-life case. Let's do our syllogism one more time. We're going to do it a few more times before we're done this weekend. Premise one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Conclusion, therefore, abortion is wrong. I cannot wait for some of you to wake up at 2 a.m. doing this in your head going, "I can't sleep. I will have succeeded." Now, instead of responding and refuting that syllogism, people are going to respond to you many times with groups of arguments that don't work. Here's what they're going to do. They will assume rather than argue. They will assert rather than argue. They will attack rather than argue. And I think I'll shorten it to 4 tonight because I'll pick up a few more tomorrow. They hide behind the hard cases. So let's look at each of these, and then we're going to get you out of here on time tonight. The first thing people do is they assume rather than argue. We've already touched on this, but I want to just add a few more things to this. They assume the unborn aren't human. They don't argue for it. How many of you have read The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn? Do you remember the part in that story where Huck is late coming back for supper and he knows Aunt Sally is going to give it to him? He's been out fooling around with his friends. I think it's, is it chapter 32? I forget, but it's in there somewhere. He is late coming back. He and his buddies have been playing around, and Huck has got to come up with a lie so that Aunt Sally doesn't give it to him. He walks in and he says, "Oh, Aunt Sally, we were late because we were on a steamboat and it blew a cylinder head." I mean, flat out lie. Aunt Sally goes, "Well, was anybody hurt?" "No, ma'am. Killed a Negro, but nobody was hurt." Aunt Sally says, "Well, that's good, because sometimes people do get hurt." What was just assumed about the black man? That he wasn't one of us. Flashback 2 years ago, anniversary of Roe v. Wade. President Barack Obama celebrating the Supreme Court case that gave us abortion on demand said this: "Today is a day we celebrate for our daughters, because this is a nation where everyone has the right to pursue their own dreams." What was just assumed about the unborn? And not one journalist raised his hand and said, "Mr. President, with all due respect, does, quote, everyone, unquote, include the unborn?" This is what I mean about assumptions, folks. And you need to develop a very keen ear for hearing these assumptions and dealing with them and calling them out into the open graciously so they can be dealt with. Make people argue for their view. Don't let them get away with assuming their view. That's called begging the question. That's where you assume the very thing you're trying to prove. Instead of arguing your view, you simply assume it. Do you have a brother? You, do you have a brother? No. Do you have a mom? Okay, I have a question. Have you stopped back-talking to your mom? There's hesitation up in the front row. You have? We're glad to hear that. Did that come through prayer and deliverance or repentance, or what brought that about? Repentance, okay. Now, was this a fair question? What did I do? I assumed what I was trying to prove. Did I give you any evidence that he backtalked to his mother? No, none at all. By the way, see me at the end of the night. There will be a reward for you. We're going to send you home with a free copy of the Life is Best TV show for letting me use you as an example. So I tell everybody, sit near the front, you get all the goodies. If I pick on you, you usually get something free from me. I can just see the front row tomorrow. Anyway, I assumed something I did not argue for. We have got to become so well in tune to people doing this that we can just spot it immediately. Every time people argue for abortion, nearly every time they're assuming the unborn aren't human. Almost every time. There's a few academics who say, we know the unborn are human, we'll kill them anyway because women have a right to absolute bodily autonomy. I'll deal a little bit with that tomorrow. But most of the people you talk to aren't going there. They're just assuming the unborn aren't human. Second thing people do, they not only assert, or not only assume, they assert. Instead of actually making an argument, they just make an assertion. Women have a right to choose. Is that an argument or an assertion? Because I gave you no what? No evidence. There's no premise, conclusion there. How about this? Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. Is that an argument or an assertion? Argument. How about this? My wife is not here tonight. Therefore, she has eloped with Elvis in Las Vegas and Michael Jackson is doing the music. I'm dead if this is not recorded, right? No. So, is that an argument or assertion? Are you sure? Is there any brave soul that will say argument? You are right, sir. And no, you won't get a free television series. You're right, and I'll tell you why. What was the key word that tipped you off that I was making an argument? Therefore. Now, is it a good argument? It's a horrible argument. Does the premise Does the conclusion follow from the premise? No. Here's the good news. A lot of what passes for arguments for abortion doesn't even rise to the level of an argument. It's just an assertion. If I say there's a pink elephant swinging from the exit sign back there, a couple of you just looked. Who bears the burden of proof? I do, because why? I made the claim. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about how you reverse the burden of proof in discussions on abortion and Christianity using a tactic my friend Greg Kokel came up with called the Columbo tactic. And we'll talk about that and apply it to this issue here. But we get people who make assertions all the time on abortion. Well, the unborn aren't human and don't have a right to life. Oh, why is that? They're not self-aware. Excuse me, why does self-awareness matter in the first place? Don't they need to argue for that? Maybe I think what makes us valuable is a belly button that sticks out rather than in. How is my assertion any less arbitrary than yours? See, they've got to argue for this. We let them get away with way too much. Way too much. Or to quote Trump, it's broken and we're going to fix it. I got to work on that one, but I am working on it. All right. This is the biggie, third thing people do. This is probably the biggest violation. They attack rather than argue. They don't deal with a syllogism. They just attack you personally. My favorite philosopher, comedian Roseanne Barr, said the following. You know who I can't stand? It's them people who are anti-abortion. I hate them. They're nothing but a bunch of old, geeky, hideous, perverted old men who want you to keep spitting out kids so they can molest them. That's the exact quote. It's in my book if you don't believe it. Now, instead of defending ourselves, here's the right answer. Okay, Roseanne, you're right. The entire pro-life movement is nothing but a bunch of perverted old men, including the women amongst us. How does it follow that A, the unborn aren't human, or B, we may intentionally kill them? Does Roseanne's comment refute the syllogism we've been repeating tonight? Leaves it untouched, correct? Even if she's right, it doesn't refute the argument. Not at all. I cannot begin to tell you how often we see this in the abortion debate. Oh, you're against abortion? How many unwanted kids have you adopted? And we get all defensive. Oh, well, wait. Suppose I'm a cruel and heartless conservative who doesn't give a rip about kids once they're born. Suppose you're right about that. How does it follow that my alleged unwillingness to adopt a child justifies an abortionist killing one? What if I said to you, unless you agree to adopt my three sons by noon tomorrow, I shall execute them? If you turn me down, am I justified committing evil against my sons? That's the problem that's going on here. They attack the person. They don't deal with the argument. They just attack the person. And we see this over and over again with pro-lifers. Now, I'll give you another example of this. I did a debate a number of years ago at the University of Calgary up in Canada. And this was probably 15 years ago now. And this woman was at this debate with me and a professor, John Baker, up there. And I had laid out a case for the pro-life view using science. I had embryology sources with me. I had done a pretty good job researching this, knew my opponent pretty well. And at the end of the debate, I was sitting on the steps along the front stage just talking to students informally. The official debate was over. And this woman came up to me. Her eyes are on fire. And she points at me and says, "You're a man. You can't get pregnant. You don't even belong here." Now, she didn't say that to my opponent, who was also a man, just me. I said, "Well, what does my gender have to do with the evidence I presented?" She said, "I don't care about your evidence. I care about you. You're a man. Last time I checked, you guys aren't getting pregnant. And in a moment of weakness that I've since repented from, I looked at her and said, well, how do you know that I'm a man? That's kind of dangerous in the era of Caitlyn Jenner, isn't it? It's Brucey. No, now seriously, how do you know I'm a man? And I mean, her mouth drops open, and inside I'm going, no, I did not just say that. She said, well, you have a deep voice, and I reminded her Joan Rivers did too, which didn't help one bit. Now, don't do this. But my point was this. Arguments don't have gender. People do. By the way, if no man can speak on abortion, we need to reverse Roe v. Wade because it was decided by who? Men. We also have to fire Planned Parenthood's male lawyers and all the ACLU attorneys that are male. Yeah, you get the point. All you've done at that point is attack the person. You haven't refuted the argument the person is making. And this happens all the time. All the time. In fact, in the state of California, crisis pregnancy centers now are legally required to refer clients to abortion clinics on grounds that, if they're truly concerned about the woman, they will make all options open to her. Thankfully, it's going to be fought in court, and I believe that will be overturned. ADF is on it and other Christian legal groups. But the idea being that pro-lifers have no right to do their work unless they're willing to accommodate everybody else, and if they don't, they're truly not pro-life. This is just an attack on the person. It's not a refutation of the pro-life argument. It does nothing to refute the pro-life argument. It just attacks the person. There was a book written a number of years ago, 7, 8 years ago now, by the late Christopher Hitchens. He was the atheist who was very outspoken about his atheism. He wrote a book called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And it is a running catalog of all the evils done in the name of religion. You will get your fill, believe me. Let's just grant it's all true. Let's say his thesis is right. The purpose in writing the book, he tells us, is to disprove God's existence. In particular, he wants to go after Christianity. Can Christianity be falsified? Yes, it can. I'm going to tell you how to falsify it. Here goes. If Jesus Christ did not rise bodily and historically from the dead, our faith is in vain, we are dead in our sins, and we're the world's biggest joke. By the way, those aren't my words, those are Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 15. Does Hitchens refute the evidence for the resurrection? He doesn't even try. He just attacks individual religious people for not living up to their standards. Now, that doesn't excuse us, but it does say that he didn't falsify our worldview, did he? Because he didn't go after the thing that matters. The only way to refute this pro-life syllogism we have been looking at is to show that either the conclusion doesn't follow, good luck with that, or that the premises are somehow untrue. Attacking the individual pro-lifer isn't going to get that done, because the argument can still be true even if you attack us personally and what you say happens to be true. It doesn't follow the unborn are not human and killing them is okay if I won't adopt them or if I'm a man. The other thing people do, they not only assume, they not only assert, they not only attack, they confuse functioning as a human with being a human. David Boonin has written one of the most persuasive defenses of abortion you will read. And yes, there are some academics on the other side who present some sophisticated arguments in defense of abortion. These tend to be people who are not angry at pro-lifers. In fact, Michael Tooley and David Boonin have both spent time with my staff on occasion because I like my speakers to hear the best the other side has to offer. And they're friendly guys. They're nice guys. David Boonin, in his book, A Defense of Abortion, argues that you and I are identical to the embryo we once were.
Whoa.
You're not going to hear that out of Planned Parenthood, are you? In fact, he says, that wasn't a blob of tissue back then. That was you. That was you. However, just because you're identical to the embryo you once were does not mean you have the same right to life then as you do now. And to make sure we get his point, he says this about his own son Eli. He says, and I'll quote him almost word for word, "On my desk where this book was written, there are a series of photographs of my son Eli. In the first photograph, he is attempting to keep his head warm. We're attempting to keep his head warm as he leaves the hospital after being born. In the next photograph, he's a few months old sitting in the car seat in the backyard of his grandparents' home. In the third photograph, he is along the Gulf of Mexico, 11 months old, attempting to stand in the sand of the beach." And then Boonen says this, "There is no doubt we are looking at the same little boy in each of those photographs." Then Boonen really nails it. He says, "I keep another photograph of Eli in the top drawer of my desk. This picture was taken 28 weeks before he was born. The sonogram image is murky, but it reveals clearly enough a hand bent back toward the mouth, thumb extended toward the lips, and there is no doubt in my mind," says Boonen, "that this picture also depicts the same little boy just at an earlier stage of his development." And, says Boonen, get ready, "the thesis I will defend in this book is that it would have been perfectly permissible to have ended his life at that point." Did you catch what he just said? He didn't say what Planned Parenthood says. Planned Parenthood says that's just a blob of tissue, right? No, this guy's way beyond Planned Parenthood. He doesn't like Planned Parenthood. He thinks they're intellectually dishonest. He's looking you and I in the eye. He's saying, "Pro-lifer, I'm going to grant your thesis that you're identical to the embryo you once were. You didn't evolve from an embryo. That was you. And I'll kill you anyway back then." You know why? Because according to Boonen, what gives us a right to life is not that we're human, but that we have an immediately exercisable desire for something. And if you don't have desires, if you're killed, you're not really harmed. And he says, the unborn don't have desires until sometime around weeks 28 to 32. So abortion before then is fine. Let's look at this for a moment. Desire grants a right to life. Could a slave be conditioned not to desire his freedom? Is he still entitled to it in virtue of his humanity? I talked earlier about some of you having a year where it's been really tough. You don't desire a lot right now. If desires give us value, those with more have a greater right to life than those with less. But Boonen's thesis also disqualifies newborns. You know why? Do newborns desire anything? No, they don't. They don't. I'm going to tell you why. Urges are not desires. Desire requires two things: belief and judgment. I have to believe something is the case and make a judgment about it. Newborns are not capable of that until several months after birth, which means Boonen's argument proves too much. It not only justifies killing the fetus, it justifies killing the newborn. But let's go on. Let's say there were, well, I am terrible with hammer and nails. I'm very good with wrenches. I have a 65 or a 66 Ford Mustang. I've torn those cars apart from the time I was in my 20s. I have my Snap-on and Mac tools from when I worked my way through college, turning wrenches. I enjoy it. It's a hobby. I'm no good with a hammer and nails. Don't ask me to build you anything. But let's say I decide I have a desire to build a house, okay? And I go to Home Depot and I buy all this expensive tools. And I buy one of those staple air guns that shoots the nail right into the stud so you don't have to hammer it. I've seen contractors use these things. But I don't shoot the lumber. I shoot myself in the head. I live, but it damages the part of my brain that controls desire, so I no longer desire anything. Have I forfeited my right to life? On Bunin's argument, how can he say no? I no longer have an immediately exercisable desire for anything. What if a nirvana drug were developed where you take it and you don't desire anything? Would you lose your personhood over that? My friend Frank Beckwith has another example. Suppose a surgeon surgically alters the brain of a developing fetus at 5 months before Bunin's cutoff for desires. The child is born, and at age 5, he is killed so his organs can be harvested for people who are suffering from illness. If the child didn't desire anything because his brain had been surgically altered years before, on what grounds would Bunin say that was wrong, what was done to the child? Do you see the problem with these arguments? They result in savage inequality. We as pro-lifers have a better equality story, men and women. We can argue for human equality, and we can ground it. Our culture is obsessed with equality, isn't it? They want racial equality. They want income equality. They want economic, social equality, marital equality. You know, it's all over the place, right? Here's the problem. In a universe that came from nothing and was caused by nothing, how does anything have value in a right to life? We're cosmic junk, right? But if we're equally valuable because we equally bear the impress of our Maker, then you don't get that savage inequality. You get true equality. We've got a good story to tell this culture. It's high time we get confident that it's a better story than the one they're giving us. It's a lot better story. Now, I want to wrap up with the last thing people do. They hide behind the hard cases. I told you we were getting out at 9. No, actually, I said 11:30, but I meant 9. And we are going to end at 9. You make your case for the pro-life view, and somebody brings up rape. Two types of people are going to bring up rape: the inquirer and the crusader. And you treat them differently. The inquirer is intellectually honest. She just wants to know. She's heard your pro-life case. She gets it. But emotionally, she's thinking, man, I know women who've been sexually assaulted. I just don't know how we can say to them that they got to give birth. And so she asks you, well, what about rape? You're going to answer her different than the crusader. The crusader has no interest in hearing your answer. He just wants to make you look bad by painting you as an extremist. So let's talk about the inquirer first. She says, well, okay, I get what you're saying, but how do I reconcile my pro-life sentiments with looking at a woman who's, you know, every time she looks at that kid, she's going to remember the assault she went through. And by the way, can I just tell you right now, do not ever do what some pro-lifers have done. They totally minimize that woman's pain. They just say, oh, well, you know, if she just gives birth, she'll feel fine. Really? That's just flat wrong. And it also, you lose huge points because then you don't look like you care about people. Our hearts ought to break for that woman. And our response should be, you know, you're absolutely right. She has suffered an unbelievable injustice. And we can't even begin to imagine it. I certainly can't begin to imagine what she's been through. How could I? And I share your concern about her. Given we both share concern for this woman, I'm wondering what you think about this. How should a civil society treat innocent human beings who remind us of a painful event? What did we just return the issue to? What is the unborn? Is it okay to kill them so we can feel better? If I had a 2-year-old up here and his father was a rapist, would it be okay to execute him if it made someone else feel better? That's the point we're making here. Now, the inquirer will begin to understand the moral logic that's in play. How should a civil society treat innocent human beings that remind us of a painful event? They immediately begin to see, oh yeah, we've got to answer the question, what is the unborn here, don't we? Now, the crusader isn't interested in that. He just wants to make you look bad. You're going to deal with him differently. He's going to say, well, how can you call yourself a compassionate, conservative pro-lifer when you just want women to suffer? You're going to play a little hardball with him. You're going to say, okay, for the sake of this discussion, I'm going to grant that we allow abortion in cases of rape. It's not my position, but we're going to grant it for the sake of this discussion. Will you join me in opposing all other abortions that are not rape-related? What's his answer? No, women have a fundamental right to an abortion for any reason they want. Fine, then defend that. Don't hide behind rape victims. You see how we call his bluff? And make him defend what his true position is rather than the one he wants to make us think is his position, we call his bluff. Now, I had a funny little discussion on this, and I'll close with this tonight. About a year and a half ago, I was coming back, my last trip of the year in November before the holiday break, and I was bone tired. I was flying home from, I think, Detroit. No, I was flying to from Detroit to Orlando. I had one last event to do, and then I was done for the year. And I jump on the plane, and I got on the 757, and I got near the rear of the plane, and I had that exit row toward the rear of the 757 where you got about a football field in front of you of leg room. It's awesome. And I sat down and thought, glory to God. I did not pay attention to who I was sitting next to. I had the aisle seat. I thought, I'm napping. Seated next to me, there's a whole section in the plane that's getting ready to go on a cruise. They're in their hats. They're all partied out. They're, you know, they're 55 and up, and they're all going on a cruise. And they're headed to Florida. They're going to go to Disney World for 3 days, then they're off to the Bahamas, right? All right. I sit down, and stupid me, I did not put my book in my case. I just put it on my lap. And the woman who was right next to me, her and her husband, she looks at the book and says, oh, what's that about? Her husband then turns to me and says, she's scared to death to fly. She's going to talk your leg off the entire plane. I said, well, it's a book about pro-life. And she said, well, I'm against abortion, but I will tell you one thing I will never agree to. I will never agree that a woman who's been raped should be told she has to give birth. Nothing you say will ever change my mind. Great. So I said, I decided at that point, I'm doomed, I might as well engage. So here's what I said to her. I said, how many people, how many humans are involved in a pregnancy that results from rape? Two or three? She turned to her husband and said, two. No, three. Three. Yeah, three. I said, I agree. You got the rapist, right? You got the woman, and you got the child. I said, let's talk about how we ought to treat all three. I said, let's talk about the rapist. Do you think he should be executed for his crime? No, I'm against the death penalty. I think he should go to jail for the rest of his life. Her husband turns to her at that point and says, honey, this is not going to end well for you. I said, okay. How about the woman? Should we execute her? No, that's what those Islamic countries do. They do those honor killings. The woman gets raped and they kill her. I said, yeah, that's barbaric, isn't it? I said, how about the child? Should her child be executed? Silence. I feel like you're cornering me. I said to her very gently, I said, can I make an observation? Of the three people involved in the rape, you won't execute the attacker, you won't execute the mother, but you'll execute the innocent child. We brought it right back to the question, what is it, didn't we? I wasn't kidding when I said this debate comes back to the question, what is the unborn? Now, I'm not going to pretend she stood up and said, by Jove, thank you for totally straightening out my twisted thinking. But as Greg Kokel has been apt to say, do you think I put a pebble in her shoe? Ever had a pebble in your shoe? You're out hiking, it wears on you and wears on you. Our time together this weekend, men and women, is not about making you an answer man. It's about giving you the tools to help people think. I'm not asking you to have all the answers. I'm asking you to be thoughtful. You don't have to have all the answers. You will get them as you study. But your goal is to drop those pebbles in people's shoe. And you let God do the rest. Here's what we're going to do tomorrow. Tomorrow, we are going to review our syllogism. So you need to practice it on the way home. I can just see your cars driving out of here. You need to practice it in the morning. Let's do it one more time. Premise one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Conclusion, therefore, abortion is wrong. We looked at bad ways people argue about that, not one of which refuted that syllogism, did they? This is the confidence you need to have. What we're going to do tomorrow is I'm going to deal with the topic of relativism, the idea that there is no objective moral truth, and we'll apply it to this issue. And then in our second session, we're going to deal with some tactics you could use to engage. And then what I'm going to do, with Dick's permission, since I didn't do it here tonight because I want to dismiss you on time, I'm going to budget time for you to ask any questions you want, and I'll be glad to take your questions, and we'll work those through. So if that's okay for tomorrow, that's what we'll do, and go out there and give them heaven.
So what do you think of these people?